Yes, in fact, March is a day away, the first day of spring, a day under 3 weeks away, and consistently warmer weather, we think, soon to arrive as well. It's certainly been an unpredictable year in the weather department, but we're confident that the growing season is not far off, and this is a good time to talk about what we can grow in our neck of the woods and get some ideas how to grow plants in our climate, or climates, plural, because we cover such a wide range from Eugene down to Mendocino. Three master gardeners from Jackson County join us. Sherry Morgan is the Master Gardeners Association president at the moment. Hi, Sherry.
Hi there.
Welcome back. Carol O'Neill's been a master gardener since 2000 and past president of the Jackson County Master Gardeners. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
And Bob Reynolds is with us as well. He is a master gardener and also works for OSU Extension Service as the Master Gardener Program Coordinator. Bob, welcome to you.
Hi, Jeff.
Let's start with the easy question. We'll start with you, Bob. What is a master gardener for the folks who have heard the term and always wondered what it means?
A master gardener is simply someone, an interested gardener who has put in the time to take the master gardener training that's given each year at OSU Extension. In most counties in Oregon and here in Jackson County, it runs every year from January through April for the academic part of it, 13 weeks of classes. And they also put in 70 hours of volunteer time as apprentices learning from the experienced master gardeners. And at the end of that time, they are dedicated to providing gardening education to the public through a whole variety of activities, from classes to demonstrations and a plant clinic where people can call in or walk into our office and get reliable, relevant local information.
13 weeks of classes. Sounds like it gets pretty comprehensive. I mean, how far into science and or math does it get?
It's a fairly good overview of essentially home horticulture. Starts with basics like soils and climate and weather, and moves through kind of the nuts and bolts of what we think of as gardening, vegetable gardening and ornamental gardening and so forth, and then we end up with 3 or 4 weeks on plant diseases, plant problems, how to resolve problems, how to research that problems, and how to come up with good research-based answers for whatever the questions are.
Carol O'Neill, you
To jump in here before we scare everybody off. It's only one day a week.
Yeah, it's only one day.
Okay, 13, okay, good.
For 13
weeks, one day a week.
It's not
13 weeks, yeah. Dormitories and everything. No,
right,
not like that. Okay. All right, so one day a week for 13 weeks, Bob.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff to learn here. And Sherry Morgan, when you think back to your own training, how was it? I mean, did it put you in good stead for? And let me ask you too. When you first came into training, how accomplished a gardener were you?
Well, I was a very interested gardener, and I actually had a certificate in landscape horticulture from a community college in California, and a little landscape design business, but I'd never gardened in the Rogue Valley, and this master gardening class is specific to our soil types, our climate variations, and so forth in the Rogue Valley. So I was really interested when I came here to find out how you garden here. And also, I'd never been a vegetable gardener because I didn't have the right kind of situation when I lived in Oakland, California, to garden for vegetables. I was also working a lot, and I'm now retired. I think we're all kind of retired. But there are many people who take this class and who manage to do it even though they're working. We often have people from the Grange, for instance, take the class.
Let me take our first call. We have one already. Here's Nick and Lolita. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking master gardening with Sherry, Carol, and Bob.
Hey, Jeffrey. Thank you for taking my call. This certification program cracks me up. You know, they go to college, they get the certification. It's basically putting your hands in the ground, getting the information, and providing the water and the fertilizer.
So you it sounds like you don't think very much of the certification as master gardener then.
Nothing. I think nothing of that. I have gardened in New Zealand. I have gardened in Australia. I have gardened in Japan. The certification, mate, it's just school. That's all it is. It's not the real thing.
Uh-huh. But, you know, for someone like myself who hasn't really any idea of what to do other than turn the dirt over, it provides some value, doesn't it?
Well, it does, for those that don't know how to do it. Of course.
All right. Appreciate that. Let's get a response here. Thanks for the call, Nick. Appreciate it, Bob.
Nick's exactly right. The best way to learn gardening, the best way to become a better gardener is to get your fingers right down there in the soil. And that's a big part of our program. We have people who come into the program with very extensive backgrounds, like Sherry's did. We have also have people who are basically novices coming into it. And this gives them a little bit of science basis in the academic part of it. But I mentioned also there's 70 hours of volunteer time. And that is out there actually working with the plants, working with our demonstration gardens, propagating plants and really working hands-on with people who have decades of experience. And that's where you learn is learning from other people.
We have so much more to cover. Let us talk more with our master gardeners when we come back. Bob Reynolds, Carol O'Neill, Sherry Morgan here in the studio. We'll take your phone calls and emails, questions and comments you have about gardening and the whole process and things that you're interested in knowing how to do on your own little plot of land. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about gardening. Growing season is coming right down upon us. It will be spring 3 weeks from yesterday. It starts on Thursday, March 20th, I think at 9 o'clock in the evening, our time. And we're talking to folks in the Master Gardeners Program in Jackson County. Sherry Morgan is the Gardeners Association, Master Gardeners Association President. Carol O'Neill is past president and still a Master Gardener herself. Bob Reynolds, Master Gardener, and works with OSU Extension as the Master Gardener Program Coordinator in Jackson County. Lots of expertise here at the table to answer your questions and comments about gardening, tilling the soil, and just growing things generally. Our phone number is on the exchange, 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Sherry Morgan, you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago that the real value to you, and you'd had some experience and a certificate from a community college in landscape work, but the Master Gardener program really helped you, you said, because it was really focused on how to work the soil in the Rogue Valley in particular. What are some of the real challenges, the real differences that exist in the Rogue Valley that were really useful to find out through this program?
Well, for one thing, you have to understand the soil. It all starts with soil. And we have a lot of different soil types in the Rogue Valley. People have to be able to go out and put their hands in the soil, like the gentleman said, and understand what they're working with to begin with, and then understand that we start by feeding the soil. We give the soil organic material and so forth. The Rogue Valley, I live in Ashland. We live on a mountain of decomposed granite here in Ashland. That's a non-nutritive soil, but it drains really quickly, so it has its good points. A lot of people live in Medford with that sticky black clay. That is a very nutritive soil, but it doesn't drain very well. So there are different techniques for doing that. I was used to being in an area where there was summer moisture, at least in the way of fog. No summer moisture here, and in this year, not much winter moisture either. We're all going to have to adapt to that change and to the fact that, as you said, not much snow up on Mount Ashland, so not much water. That's our water source for the summer.
Right. It'll be a big issue as the year
goes
on.
Yeah, it's going to be a big issue. Hopefully we'll get a few more storms that'll drop some snow up there, but we'll all have to adapt to that. So everywhere you go, there's a little bit of difference. We have a Mediterranean climate here. That is, we have a long period of summer drought. And so when we plant and what we plant and how we water has to take account of that.
The Rogue Valley is famous for pears, obviously. There's still a lot of mm-hmm. fruit trees, and it's moving. You know, a lot of the old orchards are now converted into vineyards and are growing wine grapes instead. But I do remember reading years ago that originally pears in the Northwest are more of a dryland farming sort of situation. So I guess the question is about adaptability. When you're faced with a season, when you've been growing with irrigation and putting lots of water on your stuff, can you shift around and grow the same sort of plot in much drier conditions and much more of a water conservation kind of approach?
We all jumped on that one, didn't
That's
we?
That's right. Here's Carol.
Well, I was going to say about pears. One thing about pears and clay is that clay soil holds moisture for a very, very long time, and so pears are able to adapt to that. We don't have the summer moisture coming down out of the sky, as Sherry mentioned, and so pears are okay with that, and that's one reason they grew here so well. I'm not sure if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, that's the basic idea. But the fact about, but if you've been growing plants in one set of conditions and now you're faced with a drought season, can you institute some changes without really doing some serious harm to what's going to come out of that plant?
Well, I think you really have to make some adaptations as to what you're growing, whether it's ornamentals or whether it is vegetables. You really have to adapt to things that are more native to this area. This natives in this area are used to that droughty kind of a summer, and so we're better off sticking with those.
Yeah. And we can also modify the way we water by watering very precisely. For instance, using some drip irrigation as opposed to just general overhead irrigation, you can use less water and still get enough water to the individual plants that need that extra water, because most of us are going to continue to grow our vegetable gardens, and those are not adapted for long, dry summers. If you want to grow a tomato, you better get water out there pretty regularly. But by using very focused irrigation systems, either through drip irrigation or by hand watering it right around the plant and so forth, you can get them through a pretty droughty period, but still by focusing that water, what limited water you have for those plants that need it the most. And we can also understand that there are some things that we water a lot, like the lawn that you like to mow, Jeff.
I don't water this summer. I want to be clear on that.
if we are willing to tolerate something rather than a beautiful, lush green lawn, most lawns can go fairly dormant during the summer and will still come back just fine once the rains start in the fall.
Oh, it's very green now, and I'll tell you that much. But yeah, in the summertime, it's generally all star thistles and regular thistles and everything else that grabs your socks and everything else there.
And then you can get me on my soapbox about why have a lawn at all.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's my soapbox,
yeah.
too.
All right. So let's go there then. Then what would the – if you have a lawn, you're thinking, wow, this is how I grew up in the suburbs in Wisconsin or whatever. I like to have my green lawn in the summertime, but the conditions are not really great for that, particularly in the drier parts of a region. Right. And, of course, we're talking to people in Eureka and Eugene. At the same time, we're talking to Redding and Medford.
Absolutely.
But if you wanted to go natural then in one of the drier parts of our region, what's a good way to do it?
Well,
ending up with star thistles all wall-to-wall and foxtails.
I really encourage you to get those star thistles out of there. I've been pulling them out of a field nearby for years now. Don't let those get away.
Right.
Those are invasive weeds, we consider them, and you can pull them out pretty easily when they're early in their season. As Carol said, native plants, Bob said native plants. There are a lot of varieties of garden design that mainly can incorporate some hardscape, which is, you know, pavers, patio, gravel, places to walk, paths and things. And then using shrubs that are relatively drought tolerant, and there you can look in your catalogs or Sunset Western Garden Guide, and you can find out the shrubs that take less water, especially things like our little manzanitas that are native around here. And you can use those kinds of things. You can use some of the perennial plants, the sages, the yarrows, that don't take much water. And some of those plants are also beneficial plants. That is, they attract insects to your garden. One thing about a lawn is it's sort of a vast desert for nature. It doesn't attract anything very much except birds coming to look for worms. Mm-hmm. And then if you use pesticides and herbicides and all that on your lawn, you basically killed the soil microbes. You've not done a good thing for the soil. So having a much more variety in your landscape rather than a lawn will bring birds into the garden. It'll bring insects into the garden, butterflies, you know, wonderful things. A much more varied environment than a lawn provides.
Let us take some calls for the Master Gardeners. We're talking to Sherry Morgan, Carol O'Neill, and Bob Reynolds, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Ginger and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank thank you. I have a question about beetles, squash beetles, I call them. I don't really know if they have another name. But they appear every year in my garden on my both my summer squash, but especially on my winter squash, in copious numbers. And they you know, like late afternoon in the heat, they're all over the fruit, and they just sit there. And I'm wondering, they don't seem to do a whole lot of harm, but how can I control them? I'm assuming that if the numbers get really high, they're eventually going to do some harm to the plant.
Bob, I think I saw a glimmer of recognition on your face. Squash beetles? Is it? What's the?
Yeah, the three of us looked at each other and were nodding. Yeah, they sure are a problem in this area, and particularly if you're trying to be fairly use a low quantities of any sort of a pesticide and so forth. And most of us are in our food gardens. You can manage squash beetles pretty well just by being out in the garden and hand picking them. Luckily, they're pretty easy to see, and they don't move very fast, so you can pick them off. Take a little
soapy
cup
water.
Full of soapy water out with you is the easiest way to do it, and pick it off and just drop them into that soapy little cup of soapy water, and then dump it out after the soapy water will take care of them pretty quickly. But hand picking is the way. I've had pretty good luck, but you have to be very persistent. Go out there every day. 10 minutes every day, and you'll be able to take care of it in most home gardens.
For the people who might be trying a garden for the first time, like a vegetable garden, I mean, the fact is there is going to have to be some sort of daily attention, right? You can't just walk away and forget it for 2 or 3 weeks. I'm getting a nod from Carol O'Neill.
I call myself a garden cop. I walk my beat every day. I just wanted to add one other thing about the collar on the squash bugs. You know, the reason they're so hard to control is that they have a very, very hard shell. And so I don't care what you spray on them, you're not going to get at them. And that's the reason. That's why you have to resort to hand picking. Anyway, yes, if you pay attention to your garden every day, you'll see problems as they're just beginning. And that's when it's easiest to take care of whatever it might be.
And what's usually the first thing they're gonna see, and how soon after things begin to sprout on them? I mean, are they gonna see evidence of one insect or another coming up?
Well, I think one of the things that people tend to do, especially early in the spring, is to over fertilize with nitrogen, which brings on a very strong spurt of growth. But that means that shoot that's growing is very, very tender, and that's what the bugs love.
Ah, nice green things.
Nice
to eat.
And nice green and tender. Mm-hmm. So don't overdo it on the nitrogen. That'd be my first advice.
I actually heard a discussion the other day about planting and fertilizing and so forth. And I'm thinking this year I'm going to advise people to under-fertilize. In fact, to use compost instead of any kind of chemical fertilizer or even organic fertilizers, which are very low in concentration. But you don't want to encourage plants to grow a lot in a drought year. Mm-mm. You want the plants to feed the soil, like I said, with compost. But you want the plants to just keep on trucking. You know, you don't want them to put on a big spurt of growth. I think one of the early things that you do see, because roses already with the moisture are putting out new growth. And just tomorrow, I believe, we have a whole series of classes that we give at the Extension. And tomorrow there's a class on rose bloom pruning. Ron Bombick is teaching that. And we're saying March 1st, you prune your roses down to knee height and leave 5 to 7 canes, good sturdy canes on them. But early on, now in the next 6 weeks, they'll naturally put on a spurt of new growth because there'll be moisture. It'll start to warm up. And then the aphids come. And aphids are little critters that like to suck the juices out of plants, but they're quite easily managed. You can go out there with a hose and a strong squirt of water and squirt those things off. They don't crawl very fast. They don't get back on very soon. And that's a good way to take care of aphids.
Really? Is that simple? No pesticides?
Absolutely.
Just squirt them off?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. We tend to go to the chemical arsenal first, though.
No, we should not tend to go. We should tend to stay away from the chemical arsenal. That should be. In fact, we teach integrated pest management at Master Gardeners, and the chemicals are the very last thing that we say for people to do. The first thing we tell people to do is feed your soil, get your soil in good shape, plant the proper plant in the proper place, give it the cultural requirements that it needs, And early on, if you see any problems, try to take care of those early on with the least invasive method you can. And then you don't have to use pesticides. In fact, I rarely ever use any pesticides. Rarely in my garden.
Bob Reynolds, I had it pointed out to me by probably one of your coworkers at Extension Service years ago about the fact that, and it was, they were talking about the orchards, but it becomes this sort of arms race where if you're spraying to get rid of one kind of bug, then another one will kind of come in, and then you end up with this system of like trying to treat indeed. This to treat that to treat this to treat that.
Yeah, one of the problems with using most say insecticides, I mean, people will often get an insecticide to deal with aphids when they really don't need to usually. But the problem is that you'll kill almost all the aphids, but not all of them. There'll be a few that'll be left, and most of our pests are ones that can reproduce really fast. But right along with those aphids, we're also killing the predators of the aphids. And they come back much more slowly. And so we sometimes are making the problem worse by utilizing the big gun when we don't need to use the big gun. We want to use the least impacting, effective method that we can use. And that's what we try to help people determine.
We have some other calls and emails here. Here's an email from Randy. He doesn't give his town. He wants to talk to Nick and Lolita. He says, to the fellow in Lolita that doesn't think much of the Master Gardeners program, different folks learn in different ways. It's easy to make early mistakes when gardening in a new area. Mentoring from locals is a good way to shorten the process of getting up to speed in a specific area. So then we have a vote
Thank
in
you,
favor
Randy.
Of Master Gardeners.
Thank you, Randy.
And let's go to Jeannie in Medford. Hi, Jeannie. Welcome to The Exchange with Sherry Morgan, Carol O'Neill, and Bob Reynolds, Master Gardeners.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about, I think it's called butterfly bush. It's bright yellow. I know 10 years ago in Chico, California, they were trying to eradicate it. They said it just takes over everything, and it's actually like a fungus. But I'm noticing it in Medford for the first time, just walking along here and there, not like someone deliberately planted it in a garden, so to speak. And secondly, is the butterfly bush, it was outlawed in Medford, like 8-9 years ago? I'm wondering about that. And trees of heaven, can they crack the sidewalk and become trees of hell?
All right. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeannie. And Carol, I saw a lot of response from you in the middle, so why don't you take it on?
No, I was just going to say that actually butterfly bush in that sense, I think the one she's referring to is actually counted as a weed in the state of Oregon. Yep. It's not just Medford. It's the state of Oregon. And the reason behind that is that it does tend to spread to waterways thanks to birds carrying the seeds. And it causes a great deal of trouble with waterways. And that's the main reason for that.
There is now, in Oregon, it's illegal to sell butterfly bush unless you sell one of the sterile varieties that were developed through a breeding program at the university in Corvallis. And so if you go to a nursery and buy a butterfly bush today, it'll be a sterile variety that won't be a problem. Yep. Many of us still have the old butterfly bushes that were not sterile that we were growing. And if you have one of those, you're not required to remove it. But we do strongly recommend that you go out and deadhead those as soon as they finish blooming so that the seeds don't get spread around. So you cut those spent blossoms off as they form during the year, and you'll be just fine with that.
Can you deadhead them like roses? Just pull the blossoms off?
No.
Cut the blossom off.
I have to say, I'll say one more thing about – two more things about butterfly bushes. I was interested to hear that she thought they were yellow, the ones that she was seeing. There is a kind – now, I'm not sure that I'm going to get this correct because I don't have my reference material. Buddleia weyeriana, which has sort of globular yellows blossoms on it. That, I think, is still available and fine. It doesn't spread. But the other one, the purple one that has these long terminal, what we call panicles at the end, that's the one that's so invasive. And for butterfly bushes, if you've got one of those, you need to cut it down just about now to about 18 inches off the ground, because those things grow about 8 feet a year. And if you want to clip the terminal, the end blossoms off, if you don't cut them down, they're going to be 25 feet in the air. So every year you got to cut those butterfly bushes way down low.
Right about knee height, it looks like.
Right about knee height. Mm-hmm. Yep.
God, we'll take a break here because I was going to get into another question, but I see we have a couple of calls waiting. We'll get to Pam and Paul in just a few moments. We're talking to Sherry Morgan, Carol O'Neill, and Bob Reynolds, all master gardeners in Jackson County. Lots of great stuff to talk about as the growing season approaches, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Sherry, Carol, and Bob in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about gardening today because spring is less than 3 weeks away now. Starts on March 20th, growing season not far behind. In fact, I need to ask about exactly when we consider this growing season. Of our guests, who are all master gardeners, Bob Reynolds is the Master Gardener Program Coordinator for Jackson County, working part-time for OSU Extension Service. Carol O'Neill is past president of the Jackson County Master Gardeners. Sherry Morgan, the current president of the Master Gardeners Association in Jackson County. Let those cards and letters come in now as we can answer questions about gardening and just taking care of plants generally in this growing season. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sherry, Carol, and Bob.
Hi, well, it's a happy subject talking about planting our new gardens for the new season. One of the things I've heard is if you squish the aphids, the smell will attract like ladybugs and wasps and other predators. And I highly recommend getting chickens because they'll go around your yard and they'll eat a lot of the bugs. Free feed for the chickens, and it helps control the pests.
Will the chickens eat the plants too, though?
Yes.
Well, you got to pull them out when the blueberries start appearing. But my big thing right now is I'm doing everything I can to educate people on the neonicotinoids in the sprays, and also they're in the soils of the plants, and they're contributing to the die-off of the bees, which provide a third of all of our food. So I'm just wondering what you all are doing to educate and what you would recommend. I know there's a lot of different plants we can plant for the bees and the pollinators year-round to help feed them, because these huge monoculture crops that you mostly see out west, in the Midwest are really harmful because they only flower once and usually they're sprayed and all that. So I'm just trying to get the word out, and I'm wondering if the master gardeners are working on that and what
right.
they're doing.
All right. Thanks for the question, okay. Pam. Appreciate it. Very hot issue right now in Oregon, obviously, because of the massive bee die-off last year caused by one of the neonicotinoids. Nicotinoid is not an accident. It is a based on a nicotine substance, and dinotefuran, I guess, was the one that killed all the bees up in Wilsonville. But what's the word you're getting out, Bob Reynolds?
Well, it's basically it comes back to what Sherry's mentioning earlier. Using an integrated pest management approach, start with cultivating things, and very slowly only move up to the use of a pesticide, and then make sure you know exactly what the pesticide is and what it's used for. Read the labels and use it properly. But very seldom do we as home gardeners really need to do that. And I think that your caller here is right on when she says, let's plant things that attract the beneficials and the other pollinators, and have a large variety of plants in your home ecosystem. Along that line, I might mention that one of the things that we're doing is on the 17th of June, and that week in June is National Pollinator Week, and we're having a professor from the university, Dr. Gail Longolato, whose research interest is in the relationship between home gardens and pollinators. And she'll be down giving a class that she's calling Planet and They Will Come. It's a class for gardening for pollinators, adding an extra dimension to your home garden. And it just helps protect the other things you have in your garden, your vegetables, what have you, from the bad beasts.
So you don't need to think of this as in terms of something that just the agriculture industry can take care of. The fact is that people in their own backyards can do something about it.
We all have a role to play, that's for sure.
I'm curious about that part, though, about squeezing aphids. Was there anything on to that?
Never heard of that. Have you?
No, that's kind of a new one on me.
I had heard that, and it might not hurt. I mean, if we walk into a house, and I did this yesterday. My wife had the crock pot going all day with a roast in it, and my goodness, was I attracted to the kitchen very immediately. And we know for a fact that that the insects out there do have very strong senses of smell, that they are attracted to various pheromones, various scents, and there's no reason to think that that wouldn't be appropriate.
You know, one thing we have talked about on previous gardening segments here in the Exchange is the idea that you don't want to plant just one thing in your garden. If you get a good variety of stuff, it's going to attract enough of a mix of critters that want to live near those things as well that you'll be able to get some sort of balance of nature out there. But if you do a monoculture, if you're growing just corn, just tomatoes, something like that, you're really kind of asking for trouble, aren't you?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yes, right on.
All right, let us take a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob, Carol, and Sherry.
Well, I've got a question and a story.
Mm-hmm.
The question, I've got a pair of orange trees. Can I name a business on the air?
Sure.
I raised these from seeds I got out of oranges at the Powderhorn Cafe in Grants Pass.
Excellent.
And I raised them from seeds, and I've got them in the biggest pots I can find. I've got big windows, so they get plenty of light in the wintertime. I put them indoors in the wintertime and outdoors in spring, summer, early fall. The problem is they have never blossomed, and they have never they've never produced fruit. And I'm absolutely sure they're root bound. Can you prune a tree like that safely?
Let's see. I'll talk about that a little bit. Well, if you're absolutely sure they're root bound, then they definitely need to be repotted. And if you've never put anything else in the soil besides what you initially started them in, and you've watered plants in containers, when you water in the container, even if you start out with some fertilizer in there, you're leaching fertilizer out of there, every nutrients out of there, every time you water.
So Miracle-Gro, yeah.
Well, Miracle-Gro, okay. I would say, I've grown lemons before, but not oranges, and lemon trees are very responsive to a fertilizer, especially with a higher, NPK, the phosphorus is the center, higher P, but not high. I think Miracle-Gro probably is maybe 5-10-10 or something like that. I think you should repot these babies, put them in new soil, and try that.
Have you got a source for huge pots? These trees are 8 to 10 feet tall.
Well, let's see if I can mention a business on air. I'll mention Legends Pottery Outlet in at Exit 33. They've got some pretty big pots. But also, since those are big plants, you might want to look for lightweight pots. And, the Granges and Fred Meyer and those places carry sort of, I don't know what they're made out of, fiberglass maybe, pots that are fairly large and not so heavy.
And Paul, you said you had a story to follow the question?
Yeah, I used to manage at Bear Creek Corporation, Cold Storage Receiving, and they had a rose giveaway every year. And it was midsummer, of course, after we'd gotten done with all the roses, I was involved with a lady who loved to garden. And both because I love roses and I really didn't like a lot of the other stuff in her garden, I brought home 100 roses.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
The place we were at was old orchard ground, and you were talking about black sticky. What they didn't tell you, Jeff, black sticky has 2 days a year when it's workable.
That's true.
Right.
That's about right.
I had broken, this was midsummer, I had just broken my second shovel handle digging into the ground there, and the city police came by from Phoenix in their air-conditioned police cruiser. The second time they came around, I flagged them down. They rolled down the window, and all that cold air rolled out, and I said, "Now, wait a minute. Your guys' mission is to protect and serve, right?" And they said, "Yeah." I said, then get out and grab a shovel.
And how'd they take to that?
They laughed and drove on.
All right, I figured. Thanks for the call, Paul. Always good to talk to you. We have an email here from Jacob in Gold Hill asking generally about Master Gardeners. How much does the course cost? How hard is it to get into the course? What are the requirements? And then what's included? Do you cover trees, flowering plants, fruits, and what kinds of vegetables, et cetera?
The course runs every, as I said, every January through April for the academic part and throughout the summer for the hands-on part. And it's very easy to get into. All you have to do is apply and pay the fee. This year it's $200 for the full program. It's a very popular program. We can only take a maximum of 75 people a year, and almost every year it totally fills. So if you're interested in getting on that, you should send me an email or give us a call out at Extension, and we'll put you on the list, and you'll get the information. So just give a call out to 541-776-7371, and then you'll be able to get on our mailing list, and you'll get the information as soon as we start taking applications next fall.
541-776-7371. We'll put that on our Facebook page.
That's right. And the only requirement that you need, the only prerequisite, is that you be interested in gardening. We will take people who are novices and train them from the start, or people who have 40 or 50 or sometimes 60 years of gardening experience, and they will learn from each other as well as from the course. And you also ask, what are the subjects? And it's a full range of home horticulture subjects, from ornamental plants, the trees. We'll have a class in lawns. There is vegetable gardening, fruit and small berries. It's a full range of gardening experiences.
The whole shebang. Sherry Morgan?
I want to plug an aspect of our class that I think is really, really very well appreciated by the students, and that's called the practicum. There is this Wednesday all day, morning and afternoon, sit down and listen to lectures and talk and work together. But then we have a practical hands-on aspect to these classes. People sign up for another half day, 3-hour session at their convenience during the week, and get out in the classroom in the greenhouses and start seeds and learn about seed starting mixes and learn about fertilizing. And we grow from little tiny tomato seeds. We grow these wonderful big tomatoes, which we sell at the Spring Garden Fair, which is a Master Gardener function. We put on the Spring Garden Fair every year. It's the first weekend of May 3rd and 4th, out at the Expo. And people who work in the practicum produce a lot of the things that we sell there. And of course, there are a lot of other growers that sell there as well, and many other vendors. But that's a great part. People learn an awful lot from that hands-on part of the class.
Basic question I have not asked yet is, when is the growing season considered to start in the Rogue Valley? And is that the same thing as the date of the last frost? And everybody's looking at Carol O'Neill.
It's basically year-round, just depending on what it is you're raising. There are things that will grow here all winter, of course. And, summer basically is when things start. But we often talk about, March 21st is kind of being the beginning. I wanted to add one other thing,
sure,
by the way, if I can just stick this in here quickly. One thing I appreciated so much in the Master Gardener training when I took it was that you get the real basics. You learn about botany. You learn about soil. You learn about how a plant actually uses water, and so on and so forth. And to me, that's the foundation on which you can build a lot of other knowledge.
That real basic, the fundamentals really help build it from there. Tim and Eureka sent in an email. He says, soapy water spray, ladybugs, and plant choice are my first defense. His question is, I am a lazy gardener, happily so, and would like to plant a perennial good bug attractor here in foggy Eureka. Can you recommend some plants to install?
Ooh, perennial bug
attractor.
Stump
the Master Gardener.
Foggy Eureka. I haven't gardened in the fog for a while.
I haven't either.
What would you have planted in Oakland? That's a similar kind.
Yeah, I guess so. I had a really shady garden in Oakland, but if he's trying to attract folks, you know what I do when I'm in an area that I'm not completely familiar with? I drive around and I look at people's gardens, and I see what looks good there. Things that look like they're growing well, maybe they've got a lot of flowers. You want flowers to attract insects.
usually insects will come in the spring when the flowers first come out. Around here, and I think it grows in Eureka, we have a native shrub called Ribes sanguineum, and it's the pink or red flowering currant. Mine in my garden right now are just leafing out, and they're going to have little pink, wonderful little pink flowers. And the bees come to those like crazy, and they are native to the coastal mountains and also here. They can be quite drought tolerant, but they can take garden water. I love them for attracting bees especially.
And what's the name again?
You want the botanic name? It's actually, I'll give you the common name. Okay. I'll give you the, it's red flowering currant.
Red flowering currant.
Red flowering currant.
Yeah. Let's see if I can, actually, I don't have time to take another call. My apologies to Carol and Selma. We're so short on time, I can't take this one. I did want to ask one sort of general question, though. And as we get into this age of the internet, when people buy so many things online instead of from local stores, has it become a bit of a problem that people buy plants that don't necessarily work well or, in fact, can be somewhat harmful in their local area?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've seen that happen a lot, I would say, with tomatoes, for one thing. We're beginning to see that sometimes we're importing fungal diseases in the soil that with these tomato seedlings that don't come from here. We have our own problems here, of course, but importing diseases is part of the problem. The other is adaptation to this climate. It just does not work as well.
All right. So many things we can still talk about, Master Gardeners. I think we'll have to have you back at some point as we get further into growing season. Sherry Morgan is the Master Gardeners Association president. Carol O'Neill, past president. Bob Reynolds is with the OSU Extension Service and the Master Gardener Program coordinator in Jackson County. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's exchange. Monday on the exchange, we'll talk at 8 o'clock about a statewide survey of Oregon teachers. At 8:30, we'll talk about Proposition 2 in California taking effect. It was passed several years ago. It's dealing with the deadline for giving caged hens more room to move around. And then also on Monday at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to Richard Blanco, the poet from the inauguration, the second inauguration of Barack Obama. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. Our producer is Charlotte Duren, our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I think I said that already. Take care and have a great weekend.